This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Time's up, and no grand bargain has been reached between the White House and Congress. They can't agree on a budget, so now what? What does it mean for North Carolina? Plus, we will talk about new pink driver's license for some federally protected undocumented immigrants, Voting Rights Act, and redistricting as we take a look at the week in review. Gernal Scott is with us. He's assistant news director at WUNC. Michael Munger is here as well, a professor of political science and economics at Duke. And 2008, he ran for governor on the Libertarian ticket. Lisa Sorg also joins us. She is the editor-in-chief of the Independent Weekly. Welcome to all of you. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Frank.
Nice to be here.
Gernal, what's the immediate impact of sequestration on North Carolina?
Well, let's start with the overall number. $85 billion nationwide if these cuts go into effect, and it looks like at this point they could very well do so. Here in North Carolina, and we hear a lot of politicians in this state talk about how North Carolina is the most military-friendly state there is. Well, these cuts, if they go through, probably won't be very friendly to North Carolina, because we're talking about in Army base operations, $136 million in cuts, furloughs for military employees, for 22,000 DOD, Department of Defense employees, that could say or that reduces gross pay by about $117 million. Dollars. You see, the effects will come in other ways, in education, where Head Start programs will have to downsize the number of children they can take, in public health, where a lot of kids, when they go to school, they won't have access, or many kids won't have access to the needed vaccinations they need to get into school. These are where the cuts will take place. Not all of them will go into effect immediately, but as the year goes on, if there's no deal, if there's no deal made by the White House and Congress, we will see over time these cuts take effect and hit the American people and North Carolinians very hard.
Not only do they not take immediately, but they may not be permanent, because as you suggest, there could be a deal, and then
Absolutely.
Some may be restored at some level.
They will be talking through the day. The deadline sort of extended until midnight tonight. So until the president gives the order to make these cuts happen, the discussions will continue.
Mike, as an economist, what's sort of the impact of this kind of a thing? Because it's not really a budget cut. As we said, it may or may not last, and yet there'll be an immediate impact. I mean, some money will not be spent. Some people will not have jobs for some period of time. Is there a way to even measure the impact of this kind of a thing?
Well, it's a catastrophe in terms of the credibility of the U.S. both domestically and abroad, and being able even to govern itself. Right. The cuts, $85 billion, let's put it in context, the deficit this year is going to be $850 billion. So it's a nice round 10 times as big. And that's actually down from last year. So you look at the total debt, it's enormous. We're talking about the catastrophe of cutting one-tenth of the total deficit for the year. It's not enough to make a difference. And yet it's going to have enormous costs. These costs are going to be imposed in a way that's going to maximize the pain that we feel from a saving that's of no consequence. And so what we've done is we've taken little Betsy out and we've tied her to the railroad. The train's coming. And then the Congress is going to rush in and save Betsy. But they tied her there in the first place. Mm-hmm. This is pure political theater.
Political theater, but theater that we really have to prepare for. We're sitting in the seats, and while we don't have to save Betsy, we might have to save ourselves. Lisa, any sense of how people in the state of North Carolina are preparing, or can you prepare for this kind of thing?
Well, I don't know that you can prepare, actually. I think, I was talking with someone last night about an unrelated topic, and we were discussing how the uncertainty is almost as bad as the cuts. You really don't know what to do. You don't know if your job is going to be on the line. So I think, humans don't like uncertainty. Markets don't like uncertainty. So I think that's where people are at today. They really don't know how to get their heads around some of these numbers. I mean, $85 billion, that's a lot of zeros. It's not zeros that we, usually use, normal folks.
Right.
So I think people are actually pretty troubled by it. But I also think the whole thing with the fiscal cliff maybe calloused some people to the threat of this. Oh, it's just another, the sky is falling.
Do you get a sense, Gernal's talking about the military cuts in a military state. Those obviously would have a big impact. Any sense in looking at this, what other sectors of our economy and people would be most affected by the particular cuts in this state?
Well, the ones I'm worried about the most are the social safety net, because those are already being rolled back on a state level in North Carolina. So if you further curtail those, there will be a lot of people hurting. So to me, cuts to social services, health care, education, Head Start programs, those are the ones that to me are really give me pause.
Now, unemployment benefits already set to be cut back. That goes into effect, I think, June. And then cuts to Head Start. What are we, the fourth lowest paying in terms of teachers already in the nation? All of that in addition to this. Mike Munger, you talked about this being a political theater. What kind of theater? You know, as Lisa says, these are big numbers. Also, they're programs. They're, you know, we're talking about social programs, things that may or may not affect us. So in other words, what impact does this have on me, whether I call it sequestration or the cliff or whatever the term of the day is?
Well, look, they've got us talking about it. We're all focused on how important the Congress is. And if you're a member of Congress, that's pretty good. It's hard to pass that up. And so I think they've become addicted to it. They've become addicted to a kind of crisis atmosphere. What I find frustrating about it is that there's actually four things. If you actually cared about the deficit, we have to have massive military cuts, not across the board like this. We have to stop occupying other nations. We got to get rid of entire weapon systems. What we're doing is a little tiny drop in the bucket that's actually calculated to have maximum harm and minimum benefit. So we have to increase taxes. No one is proposing to increase taxes. And if you don't say that, you're not serious about the deficit, and no one is. We have to fix Social Security, and we have to fix the medical care system. None of those four things are being proposed.
Well, interestingly enough, when we were calling it the cliff, we did raise taxes. That was one of the outcomes of that particular drama, right?
We delayed the end of the Bush tax cuts. We negotiated something about the Bush tax cuts. We need a very substantial increase in taxes, and it's the nature of raising revenues that people who have more money are going to have to pay more. So what I find upsetting is that there's been an end to what conservatism used to mean. And I guess I think the blame lies more on the Republicans. The Democrats have done their part. They've done some bad things. But the conservatism used to mean that you raised valid questions about what is the function of government? What should government do? Is this something the government should be doing? And if it is, because they had some vision of what government was. If it is, then how are we going to pay for it? They're not doing either of those things. Basically, their answer is government should never do anything except pay money to corporations and have foreign military adventures. And we shouldn't pay for anything. We should cut taxes to zero. Conservatism is dead.
Well, what does it mean for liberalism? And I don't mean to add, you know, you don't have to have the answer to this, Lisa, but Mike raises the question about whether there is a theory of government at all, left or right, Democrat or Republican. Do we agree on what it is that government should do, or that there is, in fact, a role for government at all? Is that part of the crisis here?
I think that is part of the crisis, that government doesn't know what it wants to do. There's a huge schism about the role of government, some folks who want it to be incredibly small and others who feel like there are real needs in this country that only the government can fulfill. And I would say, you know, when bad things happen, when there are natural disasters, the first people we want to call are government-funded firefighters and police officers and FEMA. We're not calling, you know, the private sector to come in and save us. And so I think that there is a real disagreement about governance that is at the core of this.
Grinnell, let's get back to some of the facts and figures. How would this affect unemployment in North Carolina just in the short term?
In the short term, I mean, these cuts will affect unemployment. $83,000 in funding. It may not seem like a whole lot in the grand scheme of things, but these cuts will affect job search assistance that can be given to people who want to find a job. Now, North Carolina is still, as I recall, the statistics still has the fifth highest unemployment rate in the country. So that may seem like a drop in the bucket, but it's significant in the fact that people who want a job because of the shiny object in Washington that is Congress and the White House fight, they won't be able to get that help. And that's not going to bode well for North Carolinians who need the help.
Mike, what happened to the multiplier effect, which used to be taken into consideration when you talked about government spending? It works its way back into the economy and helps people get their jobs back and pay taxes.
Well, we already mentioned the problem is uncertainty. And so the answer, one of the reasons that people became more skeptical about the multiplier effect is it probably only has an effect if you expect the change in spending to be permanent. And so temporary spending, people don't spend as much. They use it to retire debt, and they're in trouble. A big credit card bill, I'm going to pay that. And so when you have uncertainty, and when you have consistent uncertainty, as we have now for the past 6 years, multiplier effects aren't very strong. Plus, I think the odd thing about this is the Republicans claim not to believe in Keynesian economics, and yet almost all, I think, of the growth of the 2000s was a result of enormous deficit spending. It was a classic Keynesian effect. At some point, you get diminishing returns. You can only have so much deficit spending before at some point you start to get diminishing returns.
Well, we're talking today about the week in review. Lots more to talk about as our conversation continues with Michael Munger, professor of political science and economics at Duke. Lisa Sorg is with us, editor-in-chief of The Independent. Gernal Scott is our assistant news director here at WUNC. We will talk about this and much, much more. Pink driver's licenses, modern-day scarlet letter. We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. We've been talking about sequestering and what it means for North Carolina. We'll take a look at some other news this week. Governor Pat McCrory has signed off on the pink-tinged driver's license for some undocumented immigrants. They would be given to those who are protected from deportation under President Obama's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. More than 15,000 people in North Carolina could be affected. Gernal Scott is assistant news director at WUNC. Michael Munger, professor of political science and economics at Duke. Lisa Sorg, editor-in-chief of The Independent. So, Lisa, you've attended a lot of immigration committee hearings. What was going on in the conversation? This really didn't take place in the legislature. This was a decision, the pink-tinged license, on the part of the Transportation Department.
That's correct. Department of Transportation and the Division of Motor Vehicles. My take on the pink driver's license is, well, number one, they are punitive. There is no reason to do this. This is just the Republicans trying to punish undocumented immigrants. And the reason I say that is other non-U.S. citizens do not have driver's licenses that are pink-tinged. So if your argument is that a driver's license entitles you to rights that perhaps as a non-citizen you're not entitled to, then why are not all driver's licenses of British citizens or citizens from India? To me, this is not only punitive, but it actually makes undocumented immigrants very vulnerable to police misbehavior. You can look at Alamance County, which is being sued by the Department of Justice for racial profiling. If you think it's bad now and you whip out a pink-colored driver's license in Alamance County, I would be afraid.
As you say, there is a lawsuit that suggests that there's just this kind of thing is going on. Gernal, you have spoken with an ACLU lawyer about these. What did he say to you?
Well, they said they are definitely looking, should this move forward, they are definitely looking at some kind of legal action. What basis, they haven't said just yet. But the lawyer that I talked to said basically what Lisa just said. And you want to think that or whoever's behind this, the DOT wants to think that they're covering their bases by doing this. But and you mentioned the scarlet letters situation and the stigma that could come with that. Think of things that you and I do all the time. Say we get on an airplane and we show our ID. Should it matter that someone's an immigrant when they get on an airplane? No. But when you show that license as an ID, you're letting that person know, this is my status. If you want to buy alcohol, should it matter that you're an immigrant? No. But it's going to be seen by the person who's checking that ID or carding you at a restaurant. It opens the door for that kind of any kind of discrimination that takes place. Is that right? A lot of people say no.
DOT made this decision, and yet they're seeming kind of to be middle of the road in this because the Republicans, many Republicans in the legislature, wanted to prohibit them from issuing licenses at all, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And many Democrats, there are some Democrats who are trying to reverse this trend and will mention that coming up, they are putting together and they have put forth some legislation. How far it will go, we don't know. House Bill 184 is something they want to do to keep all driver's licenses the same, regardless of your status. And how far, like I said, how far it will go, we don't know, but we'll see that play out probably start of next week.
Mike, in some ways, this gets us back to our conversation about a theory of government. I mean, first of all, what's your take on it? I mean, is this the scarlet letter? Is this punitive?
Oh, it's certainly punitive. It's intentional. I guess maybe I was scarred by the events of last May. I was in 20 debates at least trying to persuade people that gay people should be allowed the same rights of contract that anyone else. I persuaded no one, 61% of the people who voted. This is just a sign of the danger of relying on majorities to define rights. So the fact is, far and away, a majority of the members of the North Carolina General Assembly have strong majorities in their districts that are absolutely in favor of demagoguing this issue, of preventing any sort of issuance of licenses at all. So I'll admit, Pat McCrory's a friend of mine. I do like him. I have to defend him here. I actually think they're trying to choose something that would allow the issuance of licenses and not just have it blocked by the legislature. As soon as Tata announced this, within a day, the legislature pulled it back and said, no, you're not going to be able to do this at all. The win for them is to have the Justice Department force them to issue licenses. They'd like to hold out until then. What Pat McCrory's trying to do is, now, as bad as it is, I don't disagree on the substance at all. This is an awful policy. But this is something that the legislature might accept and that would result in people having licenses. As it stands, you have no reason to go out and get a license. You basically have to drive illegally. So it's odd that people say, what part of illegal don't you understand? My answer is, what part of stupid law don't you understand?
Mm-hmm. Well, and it does. I mean, if you talk about people who are here legally, they're authorized to be here by this action by the president. It's an executive order, I believe. So they are legal. And then the question is, don't you want people who are here within your borders? We need to know about them, don't we? And if you're going to be driving a car.
The answer is no. They absolutely don't want that. I've lost hope on this issue, in North Carolina at least. I've spent so much time talking to people. You know, you give premise. They say, yeah, that's right. And at the end, they say, nope, they've got to go.
Well, how does this – I mean, so let's talk now about Medicaid and the refusal to expand Medicaid coverage in the state. Billions of dollars, federal dollars, have been returned. 500,000 people who could have been covered will not be covered. This is money that would be spent in the state of North Carolina. It would expand jobs. It would expand the economy. And the legislature has turned it down. So, again, the question is there a theory of government or is there now a pattern of government by ideology without a theory that guides it?
There's just a pattern of ideology. And the fact is that this is a way of responding to ACA, Obamacare. And so anything, any money that comes from that, they're going to turn down. And it's a political winner. The terrible thing about this is as long as voters continue to put up with that sort of no compromise at any price logic, we're going to be stuck with this kind of politics instead of people say they want agreement. They say we would like to actually proceed. They don't. I blame the voters.
Lisa, Sorg?
Well, I think that it is a pattern of ideology. I think the ideology in the legislature right now by the majority is one of penalizing people, particularly the poor. I have yet to see anyone from the wealthy class be penalized by any amount of legislation. So to me, it's just a pattern of the vulnerable, the poor, women, minorities, you know, the list goes on.
Let's talk about speaking about minorities and minority rights. Let's talk about the Voting Rights Act. There is, of course, the Supreme Court taking a look at whether or not those counties here in North Carolina and around the nation still should be covered by the Voting Rights Act. Grinnell, give us the landscape here. What's at stake?
Basically, what we're talking about is Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. It's the part of the act that says, and I'll paraphrase, that these states, 9 states entirely, 7 states in part, and those states in part include North Carolina, where if there is a pattern of discrimination in voting rules and voting rights, any changes that are made in voting rules will have to be examined and okayed by the federal government. And Shelby County, Alabama, has filed suit, and they want that lifted. And they say that this provision has outlived its usefulness, and that's what the Supreme Court is looking at. And the North Carolina NAACP has been up in Washington and figuring very prominently in the discussion and in the ability to speak out on this. The thing that I see is this is a chance for this. It's sort of a lawsuit of opportunity. There are a lot of people right now, African-Americans, who I think may not be quite as in touch with civil rights as they were 45 years ago when they were in the throes of fighting for civil rights. So, I mean, you ask someone about civil rights, you drop a few names of notable people, and that's kind of where it stops. I think they're taking advantage of the fact that there are people out there who have taken for granted the fact that they have the right to vote, and they want to see this as an opportunity to roll back some of this stuff. They also see that they have perhaps a little bit of support on the Supreme Court. Justice Roberts, Justice Kennedy have openly questioned whether this provision should be rolled back. So this is where this fight is, and there are people who are outside the Supreme Court, on the Supreme Court steps, being very vocal about this provision staying in place.
It may not be a bad argument, Mike Munger. This was passed in 1965. It was meant to discipline those places where voting rights had been curbed, but change things so that you could come out from under this, as Wake County did 2 years later. It wasn't meant to be a permanent provision. It was meant to change the culture in those places, and when it did, it's time to pull it. What do you think?
There's such a twisted history of this. The U.S. Constitution in Article 1 says that the state shall be responsible for their own procedures and how to vote. But if you grew up, as I did, in an apartheid system in rural central Florida where schools were segregated and black people couldn't vote at all, the states gave up that right. And the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments weren't even implemented until the passage of the Civil Rights, the Voting Rights Act, 1965, nearly a century later. And so I think we should be substantially skeptical about the claims that the states have overcome this. On the other hand, I think that people on the left gave up a lot of their credibility when they talk about putting restrictions on this. I've seen some people say, the way that redistricting worked. The 12th district in North Carolina, it was terribly gerrymandered. Well, it was because of the U.S. Justice Department using majority-minority districts. And so this sort of bleeds over into the redistricting problem. At what point will the Justice Department stop deciding this, and will the states be restored to their constitutional right to be able to do this on their own? Because that was the original Constitution.
And do we need to re-examine? Is it now those counties, or are things going on in other counties that need to be examined? And they've completely escaped our attention because it was only those counties that we found, or states, in 1965. Things have changed. Lisa, has this outlived its usefulness?
I don't think it has. We may not have poll taxes and literacy tests now, but we have voter ID pending in a lot of southern states. We have polling places that are shut. We have early voting days that are canceled. And that is not by accident. That is, to me, a form of voter suppression. I also think that the South, people say, well, we have a black president. We've gone so far. But if you look, Obama in 2008 won Virginia, North Carolina, and Florida. Every other southern state went Republican. And in 2012, he won Virginia and Florida. I don't consider that a southern mandate for African-American president. I would also say that, there are bad things that still happen in the South. I was just reading this month that a KKK member in Benson, North Carolina, has been sentenced on weapons charges because he wanted to do something bad to a sheriff because he canceled his KKK parade. I mean, this is happening now. I don't believe the South is as far along as it thinks it is.
The Grinnell, you talked about the fact that some folks have been born in the post-civil rights era, at least in terms of the activism, take for granted the rights that have been won. But that's because there has been a success. I mean, is it fair to say, well, it worked. It's time to move on. How is that argument playing in various communities around?
Well, it is playing, and I think Lisa's right. When you talk about having an African-American president, people have said, yes, we've made it. But that argument, I don't know if it's going to hold water. I mean, it's a very touchy issue as far as voting rights. to talk about the stories. I've heard many stories in this past election where down in Florida, someone who a lot of African Americans were in early voting lines. And there were some people who were actually going into those lines on the last day of early voting and telling African Americans, come back tomorrow. We'll let you vote then. I mean, these things still happen, regardless of how much we want to look away from it, how much we want to ignore it, how much we want to believe it's not there, how much we want to believe we've progressed over these last 40, 45, 50 years. It's still there. And this provision should stay in place because I don't think we've proven beyond a shadow of a doubt we've come as far as we believe we have.
Well, one of the ways in which voters' rights can be manipulated, certainly, is through redistricting. Everybody, both parties have had a chance to make the maps look funny. And right now in the state of North Carolina, a lawsuit filed against the latest map, the latest redistricting map. Is there an attempt, do you think, let me ask you first, Lisa, in that particular map that was, in this case, redrawn by the Republicans in 2010, an effort to dilute minority votes?
It's my belief that that's true. I mean, it does not meet the legal threshold of adhering to county lines when possible, of not splitting precincts. I mean, if you look at Wake County, it looks like a slasher movie took to that county. And I just don't see how that is constitutionally allowed. So I think there was – I think both parties have gerrymandered. That's politics. But I think it was specifically to dilute the black vote this time. And I think it did. I mean, if you look at the stats, all 110 Republican legislators are white. And, you know, the number of Democrats who are African American are 31. There's just not that many African-Americans in the legislature.
Still, 'twas ever thus. Those maps didn't just start looking funny in 2010. I mean, and there's legal precedent for it, Michael, isn't there? I mean, clearly both parties have gerrymandered and they've clearly made the map, drawn the maps in their favor, and they've survived most legal challenges, right?
They have. And when I look at Maryland, which is controlled by the Democrats, it's almost as abusively gerrymandered as North Carolina is in the Republican direction. I think if you look at those two, at some point you have to say, how much is too much? And so I guess what I would hope for is to put those two side by side so it's not partisan and say, let's reject both of them. Because there ought to be a set of rules about the contiguity, the squareness, not splitting up neighborhoods, and we're going to enforce it. And so both of these states have to start over.
You've talked about – I'm going to go back to the budget cuts for just a moment because at the moment, if there's sequestration, if it goes through, we're looking at an across-the-board cut. Mike, you've said that's kind of the crazy way to do this. Across the board cuts.
Because it doesn't save anything, and yet it makes everybody – it happens that my wife works for the U.S. Treasury Department. For the last week, they've been planning on how to implement furloughs. What's going to happen is these furloughs are going to happen. The money's then going to be restored. We're going to end up not saving any money and spending billions of dollars on uncertainty. And I really do think we're at the point where our sense of the legitimacy of government, the mission of government, this is corrosive.
But if you do, I mean, if you get to the point where you have an impasse, the idea of making judicious cuts, cutting what really needs to be done, I mean, clearly that's what couldn't be done, and that's why you're at this point. Then there's no other way, right? It's got to be across the board.
Well, Congress is basically saying we're incapable of governing, we're incapable of performing our constitutional duty of passing a budget.
Lisa Sorg, let's sort of think very broadly about what all this means. We've come back several times to this idea that the whole concept of governance and what it means to be a government has been called in question and certainly is beginning to harm the credibility of government in the minds of the public. Are you seeing signs of people sort of creating alternative structures? I mean, when governments crumble, when regimes fall apart, the other thing you notice is people are providing for themselves the way solidarity provided for a socialist communist government that couldn't provide for the people. I mean, are we in that sort of stage yet? And is there evidence of people doing for themselves?
Well, in some cases, but I would back to your point about governance, and Michael will appreciate this. The problem is we only have two parties. And they're virtually indistinguishable at times. And I would argue, I mean, the Libertarians have ballot access on the North Carolina ballot. The Green Party does not. So, yes, people are doing things for themselves. And I think the way they could do things even more for themselves is to start new parties that actually defy the current power structure. And the way that ballot access laws are structured, that's very difficult to do. And I'm sure Michael knows that.
Yeah, well, not only is it hard to do, it's also expensive and it takes a lot of money. And the people who are financing both of these parties are probably not interested in having a third.
Well, they would prefer not to have a third. And the Greens in particular,
prefer,
I think,
not to have a second, to be
an awful lot of the races are unopposed. So in a lot of cases, a third party would actually be a second party.
So is this – but this is our fault, right? I mean, we need to demand this as people. We can't expect the people who are privileged by this system to say, oh, gee, I'm being unfair. Think I'll change.
There was actually two different bills in the legislature last year, and the Democrats killed them because they said, well, wait, this means the Greens would be on the ballot.
Always a pleasure. Thank you very much. We'll do this again very soon. Michael Munger, professor of political science and economics at Duke University. Lisa Sorg, editor-in-chief of The Independent. Gernal Scott, assistant news director at WUNC. Thanks so much for helping us take a look at the week in review and perhaps a glance at what's ahead. Thanks a lot. Coming up next, from the darkness, we'll hear the sounds of a symphony. Stay tuned.